Okay, well, thanks for everybody that's made it back from lunch already, and we'll see if a few more people drift in or not. Probably wisely, they're taking a little longer lunch and skip the first talk. Anyway, so before I get moving, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to come and speak today. And so I'm going to talk about, as Nick said, based on my title here, the anaerobic aspects to soils. And so when you mostly hear that, you think of wetlands. And I'll talk a little bit about saturated environments, but I'm also going to bring us out of the saturated environments and talk about anaerobic processes within upland soils. Before I do that, I'll also acknowledge my co-authors that are on here. So a number of people here actually did the work, and I just get to sit up here, or stand up here actually in this case, and talk about it. So Joachim Lesway, Slowey, Marco, Jason, all from my group, and then Marcus Kleiber and Peter Nico, who one of the two of me to back from lunch. Okay. All right. So so what I want to talk about is getting to the heart of Marcus earlier talked about soil as a big reactor and thinking of carbon as a flow through that. And in part, he meant by that it's going through a processing and then moving out through the system, and it can be moving out as CO2 or it can be moving through as DOC. And so I want to talk about the part that he was hitting on, that if we're thinking about catabolic reactions and carbon oxidation and really what controls those carbon oxidation rates. And we've heard talk about this before, but just to put it up there in terms of what are the different factors that control carbon oxidation rates? And there's a number of different things that do that. So a big one that's been out there for a very long time is chemical variation. Sometimes they call that litter quality or carbon chemistry. I'll just call it chemical variation within the carbon compounds. And so that can be one big contributing factor. Nowadays, that's thought to be maybe less of a factor than it once was, but we'll still keep it there. Physical isolation is another one, particularly in unsaturated soils where we have water compartments that are isolated. When we start moving towards field capacity, I think physical isolation starts to get a little dicey unless you have something that's really caused a massive precipitation event and protected the carbon. Otherwise, I think we have most accessibility. So that's my own bias, at least. And then mineral protection is one that everybody's now recognized as a big factor in this. I'm going to move over to, obviously, with the red box. So the red box is one we don't hear a lot about, and that's redox conditions and how that controls carbon turnover. Okay, so let's start with the perception of aerobic systems and just go with the usual simple convention of this aerobic biogeochemical engine. And I'm going to have to get into the biogeochemistry or the biochemistry a little bit here, but I'll try not to go too far into that. So when we think about this, again, we've heard this from in the morning session quite a bit. I'll use Marcus as an example. He was talking about that we start off with big carbon particles. We have enzymes that break those down, so we go through hydrolysis, and then we have these smaller organic carbon molecules that the microbes process. And under aerobic conditions, you have organisms that can do the full suite, all the way from taking those large polymers on down to carbon dioxide. And so we get the efflux. And we often write this as normally as glucose reaction. So if we do glucose coupled to oxygen, you can see here at the bottom that we get a massive energy yield out of it. So this is what we're all doing right after lunch, right? So we're doing the same exact process right now. We're getting lots of energy out of it. Some of you will, both between me speaking and trying to digest this, might go into a food coma, but normally we're still getting energy out of that. Okay. All right, so now if we flip this and we say, okay, well, we know that there are anaerobic environments, and wetlands are great examples, so that we can have the aerobic processes sitting above the water table. I'm going to argue against that in a little while. But then we have anaerobic processes being below the water table. And so if we do that, we start thinking about anaerobic processes in general. But let's change that a little bit and go back to the unsaturated portion and think about upland soils, or if we're in a wetland, even if just an area that's above the water table. When we start then adding in the soil architecture so that we have this PED or aggregate scale heterogeneity, we start having structural features where we're going to have high water holding capacity, low oxygen infusion rates, and what we end up getting then in a lot of cases is the biological oxygen demand exceeding the rate of oxygen supply, and that happens mostly in the interior of these PEDs, and we'll see those go anaerobic. Okay, so we've been doing some work on this at a variety of different locations. Part of it is at Stanford. They have a biological preserve. And so we're looking at this PED scale variation in oxygen levels within the soils. We're not the first to do that. Way back, it's getting back a ways now, in 1985, I shouldn't say way back because that actually really dates me too. I used to think this is pretty recent. Now it's starting to get pretty old. But Anyways, it was part of Jim Teague's group at Michigan State, looked really simply at using an oxygen-sensitive electrode and going into a soil aggregate or PED and mapping out what they saw in terms of the oxygen profiles. And he'll say now that this was done pretty crudely, but nevertheless, it illustrated quite nicely that you have atmospheric levels of oxygen in the exterior, and by the time you move to the interior of this 5 centimeters or so away, depending where you're at, it's a little less in some cases, you're completely out of oxygen. And in much of the aggregate, you're at very low oxygen levels. If you look at where basically the topographic line here is for 1% oxygen, 1% oxygen, you can see that it's actually a large volume of this entire soil. So we've been using something called an optode, where we have an oxygen-sensitive film, and you can then take an aggregate section in half and get these images here that show you what the anaerobic volume look, or what the oxygen levels across these aggregates look like. And so where you see that the brighter colors, that's getting back up towards saturation. So I should give you the scaling over here. So this is percent saturation. So 104% is obviously above atmospheric oxygen, and zero is zero. So we're moving from 100% being 21% of the atmospheric. So you have to scale against that. Okay, so the important point here, though, is that if you look at this aggregate here from about 15 to 20 centimeter depth in a mollisol here at Stanford, you can see that the interior goes completely anoxic. And we can move this across mollisols. This is at about 60% of moisture capacity. And we're not in a particularly organic-rich, not a particularly warm environment, and yet you still see that about half of the soil is in anaerobic condition, well below field capacity. And you can move across a lot of different subsoils, and this is really the norm rather than the exception. So there's a large volume of soil that's sitting there anaerobic, even when we're in upland sites. And we could go off and look at some of the isotopic work that's been done. Von Fischer did some really nice work where they looked at the CO2 coming out of the soil and did isotopic signature. And the only way you can describe that is if that carbon molecule had gone through methanogenesis, then gone through methanotrophy, and then cycled back around like that a couple times before it came back out. Okay, so what I'm trying to get at here is that then soils have an anaerobic volume, and we need to think about that when we're considering how carbon is going to be processed through the soil. So it adds, if you will, another protection mechanism, whether it be kinetic or thermodynamic, and I want to talk a little about both. So if we change our biochemical engine from the aerobic system to the anaerobic that I was talking about, now what we have is we're going through the first step where, we have this particulate organic carbon that's coming into the system. It goes through hydrolysis, but now we have to add in a whole other step, and there's a whole series of organisms that actually do this middle part here, the fermentation. So we don't think of it as just a single organism. It's actually many, many different organisms that are doing it in succession. So they're taking the carbon and processing it along. And if you get into the people who are really studying this now, a lot of times they'll find thousands of different organisms that are each having a unique step in this. So it gets quite complicated to this fermentation step. Then what we get out of that are these small molecular weight fatty acids and alcohols and so on, along with hydrogen, that then are being processed by organisms that we're often seeing the signatures of. So iron reducers, nitrate reducers, sulfate reducers. They're all sitting here at the end taking advantage of that. The total carbon processing is a convolution of all those steps together. So we need the fermenters to first take these molecules to a smaller domain. Then we have to have the respirers that are going to finally utilize it and use the fermentation products. Otherwise, we stall in this whole sequence. So we'd lose what Marcus said. We wouldn't have the carbon flow. Okay, so the way this is usually described is that we often use Michaelis-Menten or Minogue kinetics if we're going to get down to the more mechanistic side of the equation. And so what we'd have here is that we're going to think of the carbon being available through the fermenters as a DOC, and we'll have some reaction rate, and then we have the half saturation constant. And then over here, we have the delta G, so the thermodynamic yield for the reaction multiplied by the biomass. Okay, and so this part right here, the delta G of the reaction, is really important because it tells us that there is both a kinetic and a thermodynamic kinetic coupling for how fast we're going to see that carbon turnover. If that delta G is positive, the reaction stops. If it's negative, the more negative it is, the faster we're going to see the reaction go, and that's partly because of a feedback loop in this. Okay. Well, that's the Michaelis-Menten. Actually, there was a nice advance that was done just over a decade ago. Jin and Bethke published, looking at the actual biochemical architecture of organisms and putting it in a little bit more detail. So what you have here is that the rate of carbon oxidation is equal to a maximum rate that you can achieve for perfect enzyme efficiency multiplied by the biomass of the microbial community. And then there's this FK function here. That's basically the Michaelis-Menten function that comes in with a little parameterization for the individual organism. And then there's this function here, the F of T function, that's a new one that we really introduced, that is a modification of the delta G that we saw in the last equation. And what this does, it takes into account the delta G for the reaction, but then it also takes in the biochemical, basically inefficiency of making ATP or whatever the energy carrier is, and the stoichiometry for that energy carrier. And so basically what we do is we get the microbial inefficiency in the thermodynamic yield coming out. And why that's important is it shifts whether a compound is thermodynamically viable or not within the microbial oxidation world. Okay, so let's go back. I started this earlier and showed that the reaction for glucose. If we broke glucose down into two half reactions, we have the oxidation, then we have the reduction that would be for oxygen, couple those together, and that's the energy yield we get out. But we need to be thinking about those independently, the oxidation and the reduction reaction, and then we have to think, of course, of the coupling as the full energy yield that we're really getting out. We do this a lot, but we usually only think of the reduction side. So we know that if we're losing oxygen, that we're going to go anaerobic. And so we're going to couple in other potential electron acceptors into that side of the equation. And so you get the usual redox ladder. And so this is what you would get the delta G out of this side of the reaction. And you're going way down from what we're getting from oxygen. So oxygen would be up here. Then we go to nitrite, nitrate, and we'd see less energy. Then you go to manganese, iron, you guys all know this, and sulfate, and then we go down to methanogenesis. And so we have this classic redox ladder. And so if you're a microbe, you're sitting in here, if you're respiring on nitrate, you're really not doing too much different in terms of your energy yield than oxygen. But if you're down at sulfate reduction, you're getting a lot less energy. So when we flip to the anaerobic world, we need to really be thinking about carbon oxidation rate as a function of this ladder. And that's something that's not done. Usually there's just a switch that gets flipped, and we move to a different rate. But really there's a whole succession of rates that we need to be thinking about that are quite different. That gets tough when we're upscaling, so there's ways we can go in and average across this. But we still need to be thinking about which one of those electron acceptors is going to dominate, and what's that going to mean in terms of these oxidation rates. Okay, and I'll say in most upland soil, there's going to be iron and then methanogenesis. Those are the two big ones. If we're in sulfate-influenced soils, then we'll get that one coming in. Okay, the other half that nobody thinks about, or at least very, very few do, and I'm guilty of that as well until recently, is that it's not just glucose, right? So we always do these reactions with glucose. But it isn't glucose, it's just there. So yeah, if there's glucose there, we burn through the glucose, but then what else is behind that? And so Marcus, again, gave a few different examples of this. If you look at the delta G of reaction for the oxidation part, so just the oxidation, not the reduction step, so half reaction, you'll find that there's a whole suite of delta Gs, not surprisingly, depending on what the carbon compound is. Now, you can actually do this nice averaging and just take the carbon compound and put it into a really simplistic state and call what you give it a term of what we call the nominal oxidation state of carbon, the NOSC. And that scales linearly with the delta G of that oxidation reaction. That's a really powerful, simplistic way then we can move forward. If you want to get into nuts and bolts, I can talk more about this. It's actually Leroux and Van Capellen put this out in the literature, that this delta G of the carbon oxidation reaction is linearly related to this nominal oxidation state of carbon. You can look in their paper. Here's the how you come up with the formal oxidation state of the carbon, or the nominal oxidation state of the carbon. It's actually very easy. All you have to know is the stoichiometry, and that's it. So you don't have to go and do anything really advanced. You just have to know what the constituents are. You don't have to be doing pyrolysis GCMS or FTIR CMS. Any of these just simple elemental methods will get you there. Okay, now here's where the rubber meets the road, is that if we look now at this Jin and Bethke formula up here, and we plot it out and we say, okay, there was that F of T function that was the thermodynamic yield in that equation, so right here, and we plot that against the nominal oxidation state of carbon and couple it specifically to these different processes or the reduction sequence, and you start off with aerobic organisms, they basically can use everything. Doesn't matter what carbon compound it is, they're going to get a nice energy yield out of it, and so they're going to burn through it. But then look what happens if we start switching the electron acceptor. So here's nitrate, then you move back to manganese, then you move way down, and we just put an average iron 3 here. I'll spread that out a little bit more with different iron compounds. And then you move to sulfate. Now what this means is that if you're sitting here with a carbon compound, Nick's head, carbon compound that has an average oxidation state of -1, that means that you can't use sulfate. Why can't you use it? Because it's thermodynamically uphill. That means that there are carbon compounds that if you're a sulfate reducer, you cannot use. Not because I'm saying so, or not because it's not kinetically feasible. It's because thermodynamically, you don't get any energy out of it. You'd be going uphill. And that's really important for us to think about. What it basically means is that there are carbon compounds, is that as they're being processed, and if we're thinking about a fermentation step, some of that carbon is being oxidized, some of it's being reduced. That reduced pool can get locked. Thermodynamically, it can get stuck in this anaerobic portion of a soil. If we're in a fully anaerobic system, it can get really, really stuck. Okay, thermodynamic protection. Okay, and so if you take then a number of different carbon compounds that we think about for soils or as breakdown products, you can see here that there's a whole host of carbon compounds that sit down in this realm that are thermodynamically not viable when we think of certain iron compounds being respired, hematite and goethite, or sulfate or methanogenesis. And that becomes then a whole other box that we don't normally think of, is that there's this thermodynamic protection under anaerobic conditions. Okay, so let me give you an example of that, and we'll see where we're at on time. I'm going pretty slow, so I think I'm going to give you one example of how we can get locked in this, and we'll call it good. So I'm going to use one that isn't in an upland soil. I'm going to show you how the carbon can get stuck, though, in the subsurface under anaerobic conditions. And we're going to use this for an example with carbon being linked to iron reduction. I do a lot of arsenic work, so you're going to see arsenic coupling in here, but you could forget about arsenic if you don't care about it. If you do, you can focus on that too. But it's really carbon that I want to talk about linked to iron. So if we look at iron, iron doesn't have one redox potential, right? That's the old world. So really, if you look at ferrihydrite versus lepidocrosite or goethite or hematite, they spread out quite a bit in terms of the energy yield if you were respiring on one of those organisms, and we see that with the either EH or PE, or we could put delta G for the reduction reaction up there. All those would be proportional to each other. And so if you're an organism and you're respiring on ferrihydrite, you're going to get a lot more energy than if you're down here on goethite or hematite, which actually are very similar to sulfate. And so what we did is a fairly simple experiment, working in deltas of the Mekong River, where we've been monitoring arsenic release. We did this simple test here, where we took the native organic carbon. We did this all in situ, actually. So native organic carbon against ferrihydrite reduction, native organic carbon against goethite hematite, and remember those are giving us then this different energy yield that's coming out. And then we added glucose versus ferrihydrite and glucose against goethite and hematite. So we have this four-quadrant matrix that we can look at and see what happens, and it's pretty revealing what happens. So I'm going to give you two different styles of experiments. So the data is slightly different, but the outcome is still, I think, very comprehensible. So in this one, what we did is we took the ferrihydrite and we dropped it down into wells that were screened at different depths. So these are distinct depths going down, and I'm just going to show you here 12 meters and 40 meters down below the surface. There's DOC in this water, and what happens if you put the ferrihydrite in there and then you leave it for a couple months and pull it back out, this is the original ferrihydrite quantity that was in there, and when you then do a dithionite extraction, you find out that you've reduced about two-thirds of it, right? So two-thirds of the iron is gone, and the arsenic as well. And if you add glucose to that same, so we have little sandbags, basically we're dropping down these wells, and if you add glucose and alginate beads in that same thing, you get a little bit more reduction. So you get a little bit more loss of iron. But by and large, the native DOC is doing a perfectly good job of reducing the iron. And we can pull these out, and when we look at them, we can see the microbial community that's now established on these. And so it's really great evidence that you have ferrihydrate reduction, and you can do that anywhere in the profile. Okay. Now what happens if we switch, and we'll show you a slightly different experiment. In this case, we're actually doing incubation where we take the material out and we do it. And so look over this side for iron reduction, because that's what I've been mostly talking about. So the control down here is goethite that's in the sediment, goethite hematite, and the native organic carbon. What happens is nothing. It just sits there. There's no no reduction that's happening, no reduction of that carbon either, it turns out. Now, if we add glucose to the same system, look what happens. All of a sudden, you start seeing that hematite and goethite comes out of the system. It starts going through reductive dissolution. The microbial community is there. They're ready to act. They just need a carbon source that they can feed off of. Okay, so if you look at the classic way, we can take the fermenters that are there, and we can use hydrogen as our carrier here, basically. So it's our electrons that are being shuttled across from the fermenters to the iron-reducing bacteria. And you can look at this and say, okay, well, given the iron 2 levels that we have here and the hydrogen levels, the reaction for ferrihydrite is quite favorable. And when we get down to goethite or hematite, we start getting below the what's often called the maintenance energy of about 10 to minus 15 kilojoules per mole to make it viable. That's somewhat questionable. Goethite's probably right on the margins where some organisms will figure out ways to do this and operate on it. But if we switch gears and we go with the more this more modern convention of thinking about the inefficiencies in the microbial machinery, what you end up getting is that if we look now at the normal oxygen state of the carbon, what we find is that glucose is sitting here at zero. We go up, and sure enough, goethite and hematite still come over and become thermodynamically viable. Slows the reaction down a little bit, but we still have complete viability in terms of the microbes' ability to use that. If we go on up to ferrihydrite, we're moving higher up on this thermodynamic yield. They're going to flourish even more, so they're getting more energy out of the system. They're going a little faster. If we move to the native DOC that's in there, it's at minus one, and you come up to the curve here, well, you go up, ferrihydrite still works. But we're past the threshold for goethite and hematite. We're in a thermodynamically thermodynamic position where the microbes can't get energy out of that reaction, so they just can't do anything. So that DOC is just sitting down there doing nothing. Well, I shouldn't say it's doing nothing, but it's not going towards iron respiration because it can't get any energy out of it. Okay, so that's my long way around. So I had, just in case I went slow in the first half, I had a cutoff margin here. And since I now have my two-minute warning, I will use this as my stopping point. And instead of, I had one slide at the very end where I was going to talk more about climate impacts, but let me just then verbally say what happens is if we think about how climate is impacting the anaerobic volume, you have both supply and demand. And so on the supply side, what we really have are the main things are texture and structure. Those aren't changed by climate nominally unless we have, or at least not primarily. And then we would have temperature and moisture having somewhat of an effect. And so those would be climate. But on the demand side, we have huge effects based on moisture and temperature. And that's where the anaerobic volume really changes depending on the climatic conditions. And so as we start thinking about trying to model what's happening to soil carbon, I would say there's two points. One, we need to think about the anaerobic composition of soils, both upland and wetlands, and how carbon can get processed within those systems. And two, we need to think about if we are going to appreciate there's an anaerobic volume, even in upland soils, that anaerobic volume will change as we start thinking about different climatic scenarios, whether they're more moisture, higher temperatures, or even just different patterns in rainfall. The biggest thing the climate scientists can agree upon is that we're going to have greater variability and that we're going to have more intensity, whether that be in a dry or in a wet sequence. And so if that's the case, we're going to see these kind of conditions starting to change. Our anaerobic volume, so to speak, is going to be modified. And so that's where I'll close out. Thanks.
Can I cut him off? Sorry.
No, it's great.
We'll allow a couple of questions. Questions, Dr. Sandra.
Yes,
still.
Go
ahead.
Yes. So the answer is yes. So the glucose is actually being fermented and then being used by the iron-reducing community. So it does go through a metabolite and then utilization of the metabolite actually for the consequential iron reduction that we see. No, we're getting too much processing by the time we actually identify things. Yeah.
One more question.
Well, it seems like in 2 months you will reduce all the iron, but since that
Yeah, so either fluctuating, or what I didn't show you is that right up in the upper, the first meter of the soil, particularly if you're under permanent anaerobic conditions, that's where you have the cellulosic material that's being cleaved and then driving even goethite and hematite reduction. But once you move past that point and you have the DOC that's already had that metabolism take place, then you're not seeing, now you've arrested any further iron reduction. Thanks.
Thank you.